I've met Ira here in this meeting. He's been coming here for the past, probably before then, but so I've seen him past like 4 or 5 months, or maybe a little less, maybe a little more. But I always look forward to seeing Ira here. You know, he always is a really good guy. I know he's had a lot of time sober. I know he works this program. I know he did the steps. I know he works with other guys. So with that, I give you Ira.
Nervous as shit. You know, not being a professional speaker sucks in these times, you know, because you have to write notes and you have to write stuff down, especially when you have high definition ADD like I do, because there's no telling what I'd end up talking about. And my story is the drunken drug-a-log is part of the story. So bear with me, because there is a point to it all. Adam got to introduce me also because we both share something in common, and that's our Judaism. And before I get started, this is something that came up before the meeting, is that that was something I used. The first meeting I went to was in May of 1992, and they did the Lord's Prayer at the end, so bam, I was out of there. There's no way I'm going to stay for this because, you know, it's a Christian cult. And, you know, there were some other things that were said in there. That'll be part of the story, too. But, you know, so I used that against AA. And there's, you know, we'll find all kinds of ways to do that. But I was given my first drink at 8 days old. I don't know if y'all know this, but in the Jewish religion, a young man is circumcised without anesthesia 8 days after he's born, not in the hospital. So how do they keep the baby calm? They dip gauze or a pacifier in wine and shove it in the kid's mouth to keep him from crying, because he's literally having surgery. Some of us had more surgery than others. Right. That doctor's dead, and I didn't get to give that resentment. Make that amends. So that's my first drink at 8 days old. The next time I got drunk, I stayed sober for almost 12 years, okay? Right around 12 years old. And never picked up a chip either. At 12 years old, I had my second drink, which was a whole tray of wine because it was there. I was at a youth convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, and it was there, and I'm sure, I don't know if somebody said I dare you or if I said I dare you, because I was at my parents' house recently and I did something, and my father says, "What do you do? Just a voice in your head tells you to do something, you do it?" And I said, "No, I wait for the whole committee to agree, then I do it." All right, so, you know, getting to the whole story, though, is my family should have known something was up as early as 5 years old. Because in kindergarten, we had show and tell. I'm sure all of y'all had show and tell. Everybody brought something, and you got to show and tell it. Well, I started coming home with other kids' show and tell, but didn't tell them. And then they realized who it was, the teacher calls, and my mother has a disease called Not My Child. Because she would defend my ass to the end of the world, but at the same time, she'd whoop my ass too. But, all right, so that's the beginning. We should have known something was going on there. So at 12 years old was the first time, and then I stayed sober for close to another year, okay? Because I remember that convention was in August, September. Then the following year, in 1973, I went home with my childhood friend, and we went to his house, and his parents had a liquor cabinet, and we poured a little bit of everything into tumblers, and we got drunk and passed out. And Mark never drank again, that son of a bitch. He never drank again. He'll come up later again. But so two times in my life, I've drank, and I've gotten drunk. We got a pattern going on here. You know, who sees anything wrong with that? We drink, we get drunk. And in my house, we had a regular Shabbat Friday night, which was wine is involved. Passover, wine is involved. And if there's empty glasses of wine, I didn't see a need for them to be poured out. So when the adults left the room, I got drunk. And this went on successfully for a long time. I never in my life drank socially. Not one time did I drink socially from 13 to 33. Except once, and that was after a doctor had said, well, you know, you're an alcoholic. You need to go to meetings. But I wanted to prove that I wasn't, so I had one beer with the fellas watching football. And I was damn proud of that. That was important. I didn't drink every day. Pardon me. But when I did, I got drunk. Falling down, stupid drunk. I didn't get angry. I didn't cause fights. I didn't miss school. None of that. I didn't get DUIs. So I'm not an alcoholic, am I? I'm just drinking. I get drunk. I'm going to school with people who were drinking before, during, and after school. They're getting sick. They're getting caught. They're getting in trouble. None of that happened to me. I drank on weekends at parties, like many of us do. But I always ended up drunk. Now, here we are in, it's 2015, right? So back in the 70s, no one paid attention to that. There's Ira, he's drunk, he's doing something funny, he's doing something stupid. Like I said, I didn't get into fights and I didn't do the crazy stuff. So I'm okay. If there was a half a glass of beer, a half a glass of wine, a half a glass of scotch, a half a glass of anything, I'm going to finish it. Okay? But I'm still not an alcoholic. Then sometime in 1979, somebody said to me, here, snort this. So, you know, me being me, I said, okay. And I snorted and snorted and snorted and snorted. And it went on like that. In case you're guessing, it was cocaine. Okay. Now, you know, keep in mind, I still don't have a drinking problem. Okay? Because I drink, I get drunk. There's no problem. I'm fine to drive. Like I said, I don't get angry. I don't get into fights. I don't miss work. I don't miss school. But when I drink, I get drunk. Also, keep in mind, the first time I drank, I got drunk. But none of that registers in my head. None of it. So, you know, what's the point of mentioning the drinking part of it is that a normal person can drink, like my buddy Mark, he got drunk, he never drank again. To this day, he still doesn't drink. But this is a pattern that's happening. Everything I do and have done, I'll do alcoholically. And what I realized also in this time is I was really just begging for attention. I wanted people to pay attention to me. And I wanted to do what the cool people or what I perceived were the cool people, what they were doing so that I could be part of that group. And so I would do what anybody told me or asked me to do. And there's no consequences because none of the parents, none of the adults have seen any of this behavior. I could make it home or to a friend's house or to wherever we were all spending the night or staying back then. And so there's still no consequences. And then sometime shortly after that, someone says, you know, we can get higher. Let's smoke it. So I said,
okay.
Now, here's my justification then, all right? And I remember this. I remember this. Three upper middle class guys, we're gonna freebase. We're not going to smoke crack. All right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, addicts would smoke crack, only cool people would freebase because we know we have chemistry backgrounds. We know what we're doing. All right? And, you know, you watch on the news, you see what's going on. Crack epidemic in the 80s, a cocaine epidemic. Some of you weren't even born then, little bastards. But we know what's going on, and it's not what I'm doing. That's my justification. Anybody else ever have an issue with justification? So that's not fucked up thinking. Well, guess we're about to go to the land of consequences, okay? Here are some of those consequences that a normal person would easily say, there's something wrong here, all right? Driving home from a date one night, I, in Buckhead, and I'm living in my parents' house at this time because I'm in my mid-20s, hadn't moved out yet because, you know, free rent, more money for dope, more money for booze, more money for a fancy car, and I'm driving home, and I take a turn way too fast, roll the car all the way up to someone's into the middle of their yard. So luckily, obviously, I'm okay because I'm here. But the car rolls. It lands on the driver's side. The passenger side is up in the air. And I roll down the passenger window, climb out, and run home. Okay? The whole way. I run home. It's maybe a mile. And I have my own separate phone line in my bedroom in the house. So what do? I go in and I call my parents. I don't go and bang on the door, wake them up. I call them up and say, I just totaled my car. And they're like, where are you? I said, I'm in my room. I'm in my room. So in the 10, 15, 20 minutes it takes my parents to get dressed and them to drive me back over there. The cops are there, and the woman who owns the house, she's looking at the car, and she's telling the policeman he's the first one who didn't make it to the front door. Everybody else who's missed that turn has ended up almost in her front door. I only made it to half, you know, through half the yard. So, you know, we're standing there, and the cop looks at my parents and says, y'all gave him a drink to calm him down, right? Like that. No consequences. I don't know how much we drank that night, but we drank a lot. So there's still no consequences here, other than I, you know, totaled a car that was my baby. You know, so that was the beginning of starting to realize that maybe there is something wrong. But again, I really have no consequences, and that's the mid '80s. You know, I was obviously using too much. A guy shows up at the house wanting the money I owed him, and my parents are there. And go, what are you owing money for? You know, and I do some quick talking and pay the guy. He leaves. Another friend of mine in a group. We had bought some drugs to sell and make some money, and the one guy put a gun to my head and said, if you don't make this deal go through, this is what's going to happen to you. But we're joking around now. You know, that's the hell of a joke now, but at the time, I wasn't even scared. It just didn't faze me. And then there was other people who I had owed money to, you know, they called my parents, and so finally I had to come clean, and I said, yeah, I've been doing cocaine. I owe a bunch of people money, and of course they read the newspaper, they know. And, you know, so they pay them off, and Dad makes an appointment for all of us to go to some family counseling place. It's actually, it used to be right across the street from here. It's called The Link. I don't know where it is now. So we go to three or four sessions, and you know, the guy tells my parents, well, he needs to stop doing cocaine. You know, that's So that's what happened. And again, all this time I'm still drinking alcoholically. I don't know it, though. And we never even discussed my drinking in these three or four sessions. It was cocaine got me there, so that's what we were discussing. So, you know, it's like the George Thorogood song, "Back Out the Door I Went." And that's what I did. I still don't think I have a drinking problem, and neither does anyone else, because it's a common part of my house. It's a common part of the people I hang out with socially. You know, so that's exactly what we did. We drank, we got drunk, and we partied and had a good time. You know, I never wanted for anything from my family. I really didn't. I had everything material I ever needed. I didn't have to work hard. I just had to ask, and it was right there. Whatever I wanted. The most upset I remember getting was when I got my driver's license at 16, came home from getting it, and there wasn't a brand new car in the driveway. I was really pissed about that. And but that's how our house was, so that we had everything we ever needed. I had love in my house. If I needed to go somewhere, Mom and Dad took us until I was old enough to drive, and then I had a car at my access to drive. So I don't have anything to look back on and try and blame anything on. I have had a good life. You know, at the time when I was disciplined as a kid, what I heard my mother, because my mother mostly did the disciplining, what I heard her saying was, "You're, you know, a no good piece of shit." Not, "Don't do that again, you dumbass." You know, and being, you know, back in those days, she came at us with whatever she had handy. If it was a frying pan, it was a frying pan. If it was a belt, it was a belt, or hand, whatever it was. We got spanked. But again, there was no mental abuse. There really was no physical abuse. That's the way we grew up. If we got in trouble before our parents got home, then the neighbor disciplined us. And, you know, they didn't mind either. And that was the same way it was. We had a very good life. The pattern of abuse and drunkenness went on from 83 until the early 90s. I went back to drinking. I figured out that if there was just one line of coke, that's all I could do. But I did. Somewhere in there, I knew that if there's a big bag, I'll do the whole thing. But if there's only one line, that's what I'll do. So that I was able to control. But drinking, I still went on. And the woman I married, she enjoyed to drink too. We would choose restaurants, buy their call brand liquors. Sorry, I retired. If they didn't have the scotch I wanted, well, guess what? I had a flask in my sport coat. All right? I was prepared, always. And we would make reservations to go out to dinner at 8 o'clock, get there at 7, and drink at the bar until then. And that was just normal behavior. As I look back, and when, you know, I finally did end up in treatment, I was trying to figure out how in the hell we got home safely all the nights we did. You know, that is a miracle that we don't see until later on. We would go to parties. We hosted parties. I mean, we had parties at our house that, you know, we would wake up the next morning, and we're adults in a house, and there's kids in the house too, our kids, but there'd be people I don't even remember sleeping on a couch or in an extra bedroom or on the floor. And I'm, who the hell are these people and how'd they get in my house? And look, dude, you got to go home. Lady, you got to go. But it was just part of what we did. When my drinking, we were a team, my wife and I. I didn't call her up and say, hey, I'm going to have a beer with the boys, and then not show up for a day or two that you hear people talking about. So, again, there's no problem here, is there? I mean, I drink for one reason, and I get drunk. And that's okay, because that's what everybody else was doing. All the people we socialized with, they would drink heavily. They wouldn't get drunk, like Ira got drunk, though. And I'm not going to, you know, go into the details, but I would do funny, silly, stupid stuff drunk. Like I've said a couple times before, I didn't pick fights with people. I didn't get into fights. I still do not have a DUI. I haven't been pulled over and talked my way out of one. So there's no problem. Then in mid-1992, I was in the sales business, and I had a Rainmaker account in my business, and I'm taking this group out to dinner to a nice restaurant, limousine, and after dinner they tell me, we're being bought by an international company, and we're not going to be able to buy anything from you anymore. So, what do? I go where I am most comfortable. And it's not to the bottle. I mean, I probably, if I could have, I would have driven or flown to the Jack Daniels factory and just dove into one of those vats and drank my way out of it. That quit working. So I said, okay, how am I going to get over this? Now, what does a normal person do? He or she maybe cries about it for a week, 2 weeks, a month, gets back up, and keeps going. I got a wife, a house, two kids. I got mortgage, car payments, college tuitions to save for, jewelry to buy, all the usual things that a responsible father and husband does. So I decide I am going to smoke crack myself to death. And believe me, I tried. I really tried. I did everything I could. I even went to the point of starting another business. I started a carpet cleaning and floor maintenance business because my business was industrial chemicals, industrial cleaning supplies. So I bought equipment and started a business. And the business started making some money, but I'm still enjoying the smoking part of it. And the best part of that business is you can't clean carpet or refinish floors in the middle of the day. You have to do it overnight. So while I've got guys doing that work, I'd take a motel room and would try my best, smoke crack myself to death. And I'm still at the same time drinking alcoholically and acting like there's nothing wrong. Let me go back a second. A normal person tells his wife also, he says, we got a problem. We're going to have to cut back. I'm going to have to buckle down. We're going to have to, you know, do this, this, and this. But he includes his wife in what's going on. Not me. I went straight to the bottle and straight to the pipe. Because that's what I knew how to do for ease and comfort. And you can probably hear in my voice or see, there's a lot of remorse for that. Because it broke up a family, but we'll get to that. So this is in the middle of 1992. My sister's wedding is here in January of 1993. And, I mean, I left to go buy coke. And this is my baby sister who, I mean, I took care of that girl when she was little, her and her friends. I was really a big brother to a lot of them. And no one even missed me. That's how bad it had gotten. No one even knew I was gone. I went to go buy some dope. But my wife knew something was going on. And this is in January, and we're on our way home from the wedding. And she had figured something out and realized something. But, of course, I wasn't going to come clean because that was not part of my DNA yet. And it went on like that for about 5 months. Early in May, I did finally come clean, 1993. And I told my parents, told my wife what was going on. And we had a family friend who was a professor and a doctor over at Emory. He was a family friend, so anytime there was any medical issues, I called him and told him what was going on, and he said, hang on, you know, I'll get you taken care of. And he made an appointment for an evaluation at Talbot Marsh Recovery Campus, TMRC, TRC for those of you. So Wendy, my wife and I, we went out there, and she met with a therapist, and I met with a doctor on staff. And the irony is, the doctor I met with is a guy I went to high school with. Halfway through, we're talking. He says, didn't you play baseball in high school and college? I said, yeah. He says, what the hell are you doing here? You know, and I said, well, how do you know me? He said, I was on the soccer team at Lakeside. Go look at the door. You know, look at my name. And then it dawned on me who Dr. Green was. And so he was doing the evaluation, and he said, you are definitely an alcoholic. You are definitely a coke addict. No question about it. And my first response was, well, what does that mean? It means you can't drink and you need to start going to meetings. And I said, what about O'Doul's? That was my response to him. And his response was, matter of fact, he said, well, if you want to drink that shit, you are definitely a sick alcoholic and addict. There's no point. And it went on like that. That was in May. And so he asked me where I lived. We lived in Dunwoody. He said, go to a clubhouse on Roswell Road. Its address is 8111. Start going to meetings there. So I did, right away. And the first meeting I went to was in May of 1993. I don't remember if I picked up a white chip or not. I don't remember if I raised my hand and said, this is the first meeting I've ever been to. I don't remember those things. Here's what I remember from that meeting. There was a guy in there who was talking about using heroin, and his piss was orange. As long as he didn't drink tequila, just beer, he thought he was going to be okay. Now, I was in there for an hour at least, but that's what I remember. And then, at the end of the meeting, while I'm sitting there, on the wall are the steps. So I go down to number 8, and I look at that, and I say, well, shit, I owe about 15, 20 grand in debt. Let's see, if I pay all them off, I'm in the clear. That's what my first memory of AA was. I'm going to pay these people that I owe money to, and it's good to go. That's what I was thinking the whole time. Then at the end of the meeting, they say, I did remember them saying something about sponsorship, but I had no idea what that was. And I didn't ask anybody. But then we do the Lord's Prayer. And me being the perfect little Jew boy that I am, I hear the Lord's Prayer, and I'm like, oh, yeah. It's a Christian organization. They're going to brainwash me. It's a cult. I don't have to come back. That's all I could think of. So I went home and told Wendy. I said, it's a Christian organization. It's a cult. I'm not going back. And she said, yes, you are. And then the light bulb goes off in my head and said, yeah, I am. So I went to another meeting. I don't remember if it was the next night or because I don't, no one said 10 and 10, 30 and 30, 90 and 90. No one said anything like that. They just said go to meetings. But in the meantime, we're going back once a week out to Talbot. She's meeting with the therapist. I'm meeting with Dr. Green for 30 minutes, and we're meeting with the therapist together. And we're putting our family back together. And no one's really discussing the issues of drug use and alcohol because I'm going to meetings. So the light bulb goes off in my head, and I say, all right, well, let me go to this meeting, and I'll come home, and I'm going to say, I'm going out to dinner before, and then I'm going to hang out with the guys after. So that's easily 3 hours a night. I can get out of the house, go buy dope, go use, go get drunk, go do what I want to do. That's my plan of action. And it worked. It really worked. I was able to do that for a while. And I remember in our therapy session, Wendy and I were talking about this recently. We're not married anymore, but we're very close. And we were talking about it recently, and she said, I think they called that outpatient therapy. You're going to outpatient therapy. I'm the one who should have been inpatient at the time. For putting up with your lying ass. And, it's true. It's so true. But, 20 years later, even less than that, we can joke about it. But that went on for quite a while. And we went to a session in September of 1993. I had been up all night. I swear to y'all, this is true. I had been up for almost two nights redoing floors in this huge building. And then we got to go to the TRC to the session. So I look wretched. I hadn't used. I swear to y'all, I hadn't used. I had found an old pipe, cleaned it out, and then tried to smoke the residue. But that didn't do any good. But as I found out a few days later, it did show up in your urine. I looked so miserable that the therapist that we were meeting with, she says, I want you to pee in a cup. I'm like, okay, that's fine. I hadn't done anything in maybe a week or 10 days, so I could care less except for that one stinking hit. Now, looking back, if I'd have known that was going to happen, I'd have gone out with a bang. I'm honest with you, okay? I really would have. I'd have gotten totally wasted. Knowing that I was going, that what was about to happen. That's the first or second week in September. A week later is the High Holidays, Rosh Hashanah, the New Year, Jewish year. And here's the irony of what's going on at this time. At that time in history, that's when President Clinton had gotten the Palestinian organization, the PLO, Yasser Arafat, and the president of Israel to come to Camp David, shake hands, agree to a treaty, and a truce. So the second day of Rosh Hashanah, the rabbi's given a sermon about how if this is going on, we've got to be able to build bridges and make up with family members. If we have this going on in our lives, we've got to do this. If we have that going on in our lives, we've got to do that. We've got to get our shit together, just as individuals. The 10 days between the new year and holiday I'm sure y'all have heard of is Yom Kippur, and that's Day of Atonement. Those 10 days we're supposed to spend going to people we have harmed, asking for forgiveness. Does that sound familiar to anybody? So that's what we're supposed to be doing. So, you know, that's going through my head. And then the rabbi says something about, and if you're facing alcoholism and addiction, that you need, if you're dealing with that, or a family member is, you need to face it, you need to deal with it, you need to get help for it. At that minute, I looked at Wendy, and I said, I'm going to treatment today. And she's crying. I said, no, I'm really going. She says, I know. I said, no, I'm really going. I'm done. That's it. I've had enough. I'm going. I don't know that her and my parents have set up an intervention for that day. It's a Friday. For that afternoon, I don't know this is going on. In the business I'm in, it's a family business also. My parents have made threats to me if my behavior doesn't get better since I was probably 5 years old stealing shit from the other kindergartners. They had made threats. They're going to do this. They never did it. But after services, Wendy said, you've got your own car. You've got an hour and a half to get to your parents' house. And from there, we're going to TRC. If you don't, and my parents are standing right there with her nodding, if you don't, here's what's going to happen. The locks on the house have already been changed. The locks at the office have already been changed. Every bank account we have is now in my name. Any trust funds that you had control over, if there's anything left in them, that are in our name. This is my parents. Again, these are people who had made threats to me all my life. Every time I got in trouble, they're going to send me to boarding school. They're going to take my car away from me. They're going to, you know, ground me, do all this stuff. It never happened. I looked in their eyes, and I knew they were serious that minute. So I did. I went, after synagogue, I went to my parents' house, and the four of us drove out there. And here's how pathetic I am. Let's see, I just turned 33. Okay, here's how pathetic I am. My wife and my mother are worried about who's going to wash my clothes. I'd had magic clothes all my life. You wear them, you throw them on the floor, and they magically appear back in a drawer or hanging up with the dry cleaner plastic on them. Magic. That's their biggest concern for me. That's pretty pathetic. So I went, and as I'm being checked in, you know, they had the suitcase packed. They had it all planned out. And I was just, you know, we went into the little intervention room with the therapist that Wendy and I had both been seeing. I said, you know, I'm here. So they said 14 days. I said, I'm here. Well, I don't know, a day or two into it, I realized I had some cash hidden away that nobody knew about. So I'm already planning my escape and my first use when I get out. But somewhere in that, somewhere in that 10 days of detox, 12 days of detox, the light went off, went out, went on. I was done. So my last use, my last drink was September 12th, 1993. And I didn't get wasted, and I didn't get drunk. And I regretted that. I resented that for probably close to a year, because so many people I'd gone to meetings with and in treatment with, they came in, they had to be wheeled in. You know, we know those people. You know, some of us are in here. So I resented y'all that got to go out with a bang for quite a while. But that's the way God had a plan for me. It happened. Somewhere in that 10 days, I went up to I was in Anchor Hospital, and back then Anchor Hospital was a country club. It was really nice. Now it's a hellhole, and you really want to spend as little time there as you have to. But I went up the hill to the TRC campus, and I went and saw, I cannot think of her name. I've been trying to think of her name for 2 days. I did everything but call Wendy and ask her what her name was. But I went to her, and I said, I'm staying, however long y'all want. And this is 10 days. Remember, I agreed to 14. Okay? She said, I know. Your insurance is paid up. You're here. I said, no. Again, it's because it's my choice. They had already planned the whole, whatever the treatment staff and center said, that's how long I was going to be there. So I was there for 14 days, and 6 months later, I got a medical release from TRC. When I left there, I started going to a particular Friday night meeting where I met Jerry, Amy. But the people were talking about working the steps in there. Everybody who's been to treatment knows, well, I shouldn't say you know, when I was in treatment, we got to write a first step, which was a real drunk-a-log, and there was a few consequences you put in there, but the best part was the impact letters that our families wrote. I just drank and got drunk. I smoked a little crack. And how many thousands of dollars ain't important, but I didn't know who, how, and how much destruction I had really caused until I was read those impact letters after I had presented my first step. And again, I was done. I really was. I never dreamed that it'll be 22 years in a couple of months. I never dreamed that it would be like that, but I really was done. But I went through the whole treatment process. They finally said, okay, you can go home. And I went home, and then a month later, I was back begging them to let me go to the what was then called three-quarter house. I was not ready to go home, and Wendy wasn't ready to have me home. She had learned to get along on her own, and I had learned to get along on my own. Plus, there was a little incident. I was back in my office, and I had found a bottle, and I played with it. And finally walked out to the back of the warehouse and just smashed it against the wall, busted it. And then I went and said something in the peer support group that I was going to, and they strongly suggested that I do the third quarter. And I did. But in that time, I started going to this Friday night meeting. And that was it right at about 6 months. At 9 months, sober, I agreed to chair the meeting. And of all people who's chairing the meeting, this is, I don't remember what month. Well, I do remember. So I did. Whenever it was, the chairman of the meeting at that time was a guy named Dante. A lot of y'all know. So once I raised my hand and volunteered to chair, the following month, Dante comes up to me afterwards. He says, you'd be here at 7 o'clock next Friday. Well, y'all know how he talks. I'm not going to tell you that. He says, you be here at 7 o'clock next Friday, and I'll show you where everything is. I'll show you how to set up the room. I'll show you what to do. And I said, you know, sure. So I got there, and as we're doing that, Dante says, you got a sponsor? Yeah, I got a sponsor. Of course I do. He got you in the book? And I looked at him like he might as well have been speaking Chinese. I've been going to that meeting for 2-3 months, and people are talking about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They're talking about this work in the steps. They're talking about solutions. But it's still, that wasn't registering with me. And I looked at him with a straight face, and he remembers this, still remembers it. I said, I just got out of TRC. I don't need to be working the steps. There's doctors there. There's lawyers there. There's nurses there. There's actors there. There's athletes there. And then there's about
15 of us real people. Okay? There's celebrities at this place. This is a highfalutin treatment center. No steps needed. What the hell are you talking about? Little did I know. So that was my first experience with really working the steps, because I'd written a first step in treatment. I had done a fourth step, or what they call the fourth step. I had done a fifth step with some guy I picked at a meeting out there. And oh boy, did I feel the pressure come off. Well, because that's what everyone else said it in the treatment center after they went and did their fifth step. They just felt like a new person. It didn't really work that way. So shortly after that, I asked a guy to sponsor me. And it was a guy who, the ironic thing is that he was a lot like me. It turned out he had gone to TRC a few years before me. He had 2 or 3 years sobriety, 4 years, whatever it was. And his younger sister and I were boyfriend and girlfriend in high school. We were high school sweethearts. So that was one of the other things I noticed when I first started going to that meeting. Because remember how I said I was going to be different because I'm Jewish? Well, I walked into that meeting. It looked like the PTA from the Jewish day school, the private school that my kids were going to. Mothers and fathers in there. I'm like, holy shit. I got no more excuses. I really don't. I was out of them. So I went to Keith and I said, will you be my sponsor? And he said, yes. This was a Friday night. He said, be at my house Tuesday night at 8 o'clock. I'm going to take you through the book. And he did. He started with the blank page and took me through this book. And it was foreign to me. In treatment, I read the stories in the back to fall asleep at night. I mean that, because I still read to fall asleep. I read a lot, but I always read in bed, and it puts me to sleep. I read the stories in the back to fall asleep. I can't tell you one story. I've never gone past 164 since then. Not once. So I get the keys. We get to how it works. We're reading how it works. And, you know, while we're in there, I said, well, you know, I got my notebook, and, you know, he wants to know what that for. I'm thinking I'm going to write another first step. Said, no, we're going to do it the right way this time. He said, are you powerless over alcohol? I said, yeah, I am. All right, you just did the first step. And the God thing was still a problem for me, because I had been going synagogue regularly. I had put my kids in a Jewish day school. I had been doing everything, and I would sit there in synagogue and ask God, where's mine, where's mine, where's mine? It wasn't happening. And all the time, God was saying, do a little work, you dumbass. Just do a little work, and it'll be there for you. What really put me on the path to recovery was when we got to step three. And I showed up at his house, and there must have been 9 or 10 guys there. And these were guys I recognized from the meeting. I wasn't really close to them yet. I wasn't friendly with them yet, but they were, you know, fellows from the meeting. And we got to the point in the book, and if you haven't gotten there yet, get there. And if you have, you know what I'm about to tell you, is we came to do the third step prayer. And there's 9 or 10 guys who are, you know, badasses as far as I'm concerned. And we get on our knees and we're holding hands. And we say, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as I will. Relieve me of the bondage of self and I better do thy will. On like that. And no one really had a dry eye. We weren't crying, but people were moved. That's what really moved me into sobriety, was seeing that happen. And I was amazed before I was halfway through, right then and there. Now, did I dilly and dally On the fourth step, yes, I did. Every time I called Keith, Wendy, he said, where's your fourth step? It's in a folder on top of the refrigerator. Get it out of there and get busy. That was his response. Keith knew me since I was 14 years old. He wasn't letting me get away with anything. That's a kick in the ass I needed. Some of us can get away with, you know, babying or coddling, but I needed a kick in the ass to keep moving. We did my fifth step, and this is, we walked over to, there was a park. By then, my wife and I were divorced, and I had bought a separate house. It was a triplex over near Lenox, and there was a little park and a lake by there, so we went over there to do my fifth step one night. I got home, and my wife had taken the... We did it on my birthday. Not my sobriety birthday, my birthday. I got home, and my wife had taken the kids over to the house, and they had decorated the house because all three of them were proud of me, what I'd done, and happy for me. Because even in the divorce, she knew what a big deal that was. The irony was, it really wasn't. The big deal for me came at 9, okay, when I started making amends. That's when it really started happening. When I got to go to my grandmother's 100 now, but 20 years ago when she was 80, and I went to her. My grandfather had Alzheimer's, so he was clueless. But I went to her, and before I could even get anything out of my mouth, when she says, without pain, we don't know joy. You just keep being a joy. I'm like, wait a minute. I want you people to beat me up. It did happen, but that was... I did get my ass kicked one time, and I had it coming. It wasn't terrible, but I had it coming. It wasn't physical. It was a tongue lashing. I had it coming. Two things I want to finish with. Number one is, until recently, I'd never noticed in this book, you know, you have to turn the page to get to step 12. It doesn't matter which big book it is. They don't have all 12 on one page. You have to turn the page to get to step 12. I never noticed that, which I thought was pretty cool. Did they set it up that way? I don't know, but to me they did now. So going back to my childhood friend and boyhood idol, Mark Green, I don't know. I went to him to make amends early on. He since had moved to Florida with his family, and I don't remember how many years ago it was he called me. He said, I went to my first AA meeting. I said, Mark, that's great. He said, no, let me tell you the story. They go on a cruise every year, he and his family. So they're on a cruise, and he hears an announcement for friends of Bill W. to meet in a certain room. The next year, they're on a cruise, and he hears an announcement for friends of Bill W. to meet in a certain place. The third year, he goes to the room, because he's been on a cruise for 3 years with this Bill W. guy. He goes to an AA meeting. And that is a true story. He calls me up from the ship and says, I've been to an AA meeting. Because Mark and I were really close. We were good friends. And even though he never drank again, we were still buddies. But he thought that was the coolest thing in the world. And that's true. And since then, I've been on family vacations. And I went on a family cruise with the kids, and I heard that announcement. I was shocked. Then I learned a few weeks ago that I have a lot of friends who went to the Grateful Dead. I hear there's a group, the Wharf Rats. They said, anytime you're going to any kind of festival, look for a yellow balloon and you'll find a drunk if you're having problems. Like, holy crap, in almost 22 years, you mean we're out there everywhere in public like that? And so there's still something to learn. I hope you got something out of what I said. I sure did. And I want to make kind of an amends, but since I started coming here, y'all have welcomed me. And I didn't know but Jerry the first time I came to this meeting. And I haven't come as early as I should, and I haven't stayed as late as I should. And I've stacked a few chairs, but, you know, for that I apologize, and I will become more of a member here. And I hope those of you who aren't regular will also. Thanks for letting me share.